You are known for having developed an algorithmic theory of information. You proposed the notion of compression that measures the size of complexity of a mathematical object. The domain of algorithmic complexity is very technical and computer-oriented, but the implications of your work are philosophical and not so difficult to understand. In fact, you demonstrate that there are mathematical truths where there is no demonstration possible, no structure, no model, no explication at all, where things are generated or ruled by randomness only. How generally react the community of mathematicians to your research?
That's a good question. I think a fair answer would be to say that there isn't much reaction, because I think that most mathematicians also did not react very much to Gödel's work. I think most mathematicians are working hard to solve, you know, in their particular technical area, and they're working hard to solve problems in their field. And this meta-mathematical work, Gödel's Turing mine, is outside of their specific field, and of anybody's specific field, people just want to get on with their work. The group that I think has, the general public, I think, has been more interested in my work than mathematicians have been.
Why, according to you, the general public has been more attracted by your work than the mathematician, your colleagues, in fact?
Mm-hmm. Why? Well, for example, physicists have been more. My impression is that physicists seem to have more sympathy for what I'm doing than mathematicians do, and first of all, because my tentative conclusion is that mathematics does not have absolute truth. That mathematics perhaps is quasi-empirical, is a little more like physics than mathematicians used to think. I'm not saying mathematics is physics, because it's not. It's clearly different, but I've been emphasizing the similarities rather than the differences. And so I think also because I'm using ideas from physics, the idea of randomness is an idea that is much discussed in physics in this century. You know, Einstein says God doesn't play dice. He's talking about quantum mechanics. It's not an idea that mathematicians feel comfortable with. Mathematicians think that everything is either black or white. It's either true or false. They don't believe in randomness. They think everything happens for a reason. So I think it's my impression is that it's physicists who have more interest in what I'm doing and find it fits better with their worldview, with their way of thinking. So if you look at, there are a number of books that discuss my work, high-level, haute vulgarisation, on dit en français. These books very often are written by physicists, people like John Barrow,
yes.
Or
High in the Sky?
Paul Davis, yes, High in the Sky, or the Mind of God, a book by Paul Davis. Both of these men are physicists. But some mathematicians are interested in what I'm doing. For example, one popular author is here in the United States is John Allen Paulos, who's written a number of books about mathematics for the general public, and he's interested in philosophy, which is unusual for mathematicians, is my impression. He told me he has a letter that Bertrand Russell wrote to him in reply to a letter he wrote to Bertrand Russell that he's very proud of having. And he finds he's very interested in my work. So, you know, no general statement is true. But my impression is that it's physicists who find that what I'm saying fits better with their way of thinking about the world. And as an example of that, let me mention that I was invited to write an article about my work for a special issue of La Recherche, dealing with chaos theory. Which is a field of physics, nonlinear physics, and also the same thing happened with New Scientist in England. They had a series of articles on that subject, and they asked me to write an article for them. So my impression from all this is that physicists find that my ideas make more sense to them. So there is a philosopher who's reacted to my work, I think, a little bit. Have you seen the book by Tomasco, New Directions in the Philosophy of Mathematics?
No, I heard about heard the presentation about this book, and I heard also some quotations mentioning your work and the new way of the philosophy of mathematics. So I didn't read the book, but I read some small extracts of it.
Well, this is about the only philosopher I know who has noticed my work, as far as I can tell. So my impression is that it's basically physicists who are interested in what I'm doing. My work is very interdisciplinary, and it's difficult for sometimes it's difficult for specialists to understand what I'm talking about.
That's what I perceived. You define the algorithmic complexity of a mathematical object as the size of the smallest program which computes it, or a complete description of it.
Right. Another way to put that would be it's the most concise theory that explains something.
It's a kind of number describing another number, but in a description which is generally shorter. In this prospect, a random number has no compression possible.
Right, exactly.
Is the only definition of randomness in mathematics? Do you have other definition to propose of randomness?
Well, there are some other definitions. There's a statistical definition of randomness due to Per Martinlöf, a Swede. And it turns out, fortunately, that it can be proved that his definition and my definition are equivalent, which is good. His definition is based on statistics. It says that something is random if it has all statistical properties of randomness, and he's able to define randomness that way. And it, fortunately, there's a nice theorem which says that my definition is based on information, the notion of information or complexity, information complexity, really. And it's good that it turns out the two definitions are equivalent. His is a definition for infinite sequences to be random. And so in the infinite case, it turns out my definition is equivalent and his are equivalent, which is good. It's good when you have different definitions that have been proposed for the same thing. In mathematics, it's good if it turns out that they're equivalent, which suggests that you have really gotten to the core, that you've really identified the correct concept. So
Solomonov is the one who proposed another definition of randomness, but this one is based on statistics. Is that right?
Well, I don't think that Solomonov was one of the. There were three people who initially had the two people in addition to myself who had this idea of looking at the size of computer programs. One was Ray Solomonov, and one was Andrei Kolmogorov. Solomonov did not talk about randomness at all, if you look at his early paper. The problem that interested him, was artificial intelligence, and he was talking about prediction, the problem of scientific induction, and he was talking about Occam's razor, which says that the best theory is the simplest theory, and he was saying that's the theory one should use to make predictions. But he did not talk about randomness. Of the three of us who had roughly at the same time a similar idea, which is to look at the size of computer programs, of the three of us, Kolmogorov and myself, we thought that this concept was important because it would enable, because one could define lack of structure or pattern, in other words, randomness, using these ideas. But Solomonov was interested in, did not think of that. He was interested in prediction, in artificial intelligence, in fact. So his goals were different.
Can you foresee an application of the algorithmic information theory, for example, in the field of cryptography, the way that cryptography could be an area of application of your...
I think, as you mentioned, my theory is very theoretical. I think that its most interesting application is epistemology. In other words, the most interesting about my theory is the fact that my theory proves that it's impractical, that it has no applications, because you can never calculate my complexity measure. You can prove theorems about it, but it's impossible to ever be sure what the complexity of something is in particular. It's impossible to, even though most things are random according to my definition, one can never prove it, one can never be sure. So this makes my theory very impractical, useless for applications, but it makes it fascinating philosophically. There is a lot of work in cryptography done by theoreticians in computer science, but I think most of this work uses more practical concepts because they're more interested in the real world than I am.
So you work at the level of the epistemology and philosophy.
Right, that's correct. That's what I'm trying to do. And you see, the connection with my work really, I think, is connected with fundamental ideas in physics, because really my program size complexity is very close to Boltzmann entropy, a fundamental notion in statistical physics and thermodynamics. It's the degree of disorder of a physical system, and this notion, already in Boltzmann's time, was seen to have strong connections with philosophy. For example, the problem of the direction of time, the arrow of time. Boltzmann killed himself, committed suicide. One of the reasons was that his theory was very controversial. One of the reasons that his theory was very controversial is because Boltzmann says entropy must increase. Physical systems tend to go from ordered states to disordered states. And there's a direction of time, according to this theory. But Boltzmann was pretending to deduce his theory from Newtonian physics. Now, Newtonian physics, amazingly enough, has no direction of time. If you run a movie backwards, the equations of Newtonian physics are obeyed just as well as if you run it forwards. Which, now in real life, there is a direction of time, right? But instead of welcoming Boltzmann's theory, because it's closer to normal life, where we all know that things get old and break, his colleagues, some of his colleagues, rejected his theory because it seemed to contradict Newtonian physics, where the equations don't distinguish between the past and the future. If you know the present in Newtonian physics, you can predict the past just as well as you can predict the future. And so, I think that the another interesting connection with is with biology, because this notion of information that I use in my theory is not the notion, is not the same as biological information, but at least it's our theory of information which looks a little bit like biological information. You see, in biology you have DNA, which is biological information, and DNA is like a computer program for constructing an organism. It says how the embryo should develop and how to build a living being. And so in a way that's analogous. It's not the same as my notion by any means, but it's related. So the notion of information and complexity are, as you know, because you're writing a book about this, are two notions that are being much discussed at this time. Our technology is getting very complicated, for example. Biological organisms are complicated. Social systems are complicated. Now, I don't understand biology, social systems, or human society, but what I have is a theory of complexity in the most simple possible case, which is in pure mathematics. So it's not a realistic theory. It's not a practical theory. But it shows that at least a mathematical theory of complexity is possible. You know, pure mathematics is much easier than the real world, than biology or physics or which are much easier than human society and psychology and things like that. So it's like an existence theorem. I think my work shows that it is possible to have a definition of complexity that is precisely defined. But the reason I'm able to do this is it's easy because my definition only applies to epistemology. It doesn't apply to the real world. Hopefully it will suggest to other people more practical definitions of complexity, concepts of complexity which are useful in the real world. But I would expect that in every field one would need different concepts of complexity.
Absolutely.
So I have one which works to discuss the limits of mathematical reasoning, but it doesn't work in biology or in other more practical fields.
It's really revolutionary. I mean, to have a complexity definition in mathematics, which proves the limitation of mathematics, mathematical reasoning. You found a number that you called named omega.
Mm-hmm.
Which has certain specificities. It has no structure, it is incompressible.
Mm-hmm.
You affirm that it's not possible to distinguish this number from the outcome of a coin toss.
Mm-hmm.
It is at the origin of a 200-page equation and 17,000 variables you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us more about omega, what are its learnings?
Yes, it's a pretty fascinating number. It's a sort of a nightmare for pure reason, because it has a precise mathematical definition, this number, but it's sort of unknowable. You can never calculate it. It's very frightening from the point of view of the rational mind. So you're saying what can we deduce? What is the significance? The implications of this number? Well, that's a good question. My personal, I think it's a very controversial question. My personal belief is that omega shows that mathematics is more similar to physics than mathematicians used to think. But But if I just say it like that, it doesn't sound very like a very reasonable thing to say. You see, what Omega is an extreme case where to be able to prove more, you need to add additional hypotheses, additional axioms. In fact, it's a case where the only way to prove what the bits of this number are in binary, this number omega are in binary, is essentially by adding that what you're trying to prove as new axioms. In other words, it's irreducible. There is reasoning is really helpless. So what this shows in a particularly horrible case, extreme fashion, is that sometimes you need to add new axioms in order to prove more. Now, this is, to a physicist, this doesn't sound too outrageous, because as physics progresses, people add new hypotheses, right? Maxwell's equations, Newton's equations, Einstein's equations, the Schrodinger equation, string theory, one adds things to physics as physics progresses. But in mathematics, it used to be thought that we knew all the principles, and that mathematics is static, that the principles of mathematics don't change, the fundamental principles as a function of time, the way they do in physics. So what I think, what Omega suggests to me is that perhaps this traditional view of mathematics is not the case, and that perhaps also in mathematics, even if we stay within the same field, like number theory, elementary number theory, it may be necessary to add new principles in order to make progress. This is called a quasi-empirical view of the nature of mathematics, and the book by Timosko, who used to be a philosopher at Smith College, unfortunately he died recently, New Directions in the Philosophy of Mathematics. This book was just reprinted by Princeton University Press and contains many articles that Timosko believes support a quasi-empirical view of the nature of mathematics, including two articles of mine, some articles by philosophers such as Lakatos, yes. Bre Lakatos, also some articles by and Hilary Putnam, a philosopher at Harvard. I believe there are no articles by Quine, but I think Quine's work is referenced. There are articles there also by computer scientists and mathematicians. So this is my feeling as to what this means, but I think a great deal more research and discussion is necessary to try to clarify to try to go further with this. In a way, all I'm doing is continuing with the work of Gödel in 1931 and Turing in 1936. It's just that I'm trying to make, I think in a way my work, things look worse. How do you say, makes the question more pressing. I don't know how to say that well. So in a way, all of this crisis began with Gödel in 1931 and Turing in 1936. What I've been trying to see is how bad it can be. And that Omega seems to go as far. Omega seems to be sort of a worst case for mathematical reasoning.
I understand.
Yeah.
So if we have to compare with another a huge number which is known from the large public, like pi. Pi is a huge number that can be generated by a small computer program.
That's right.
But it seems that its decimals have no particular pattern. But pi is not a random number.
Well, yes. You see, what you're pointing out is that there are meanings of the word random used by people which are different from the meaning that I give it in my theory. According to my theory, as you point out, unfortunately pi is not at all random, because it can be compressed into a small computer program for calculating it. However, there are many people who are interested in pi, like the Borwein brothers in Simon Fraser University in Canada, or what are the name of those two Russians in New York? They're also brothers, the Chudnovsky brothers in New York. The people who are calculating digits of pi, billions of digits of pi, looking to see if every digit is as likely as every other. And if you just look at pi locally, instead of globally, there does seem to be no pattern. There is a pattern in that it's the digits of pi, right? But if you didn't know it's the digits of pi and you just look at little pieces of it, it seems that there is no structure. So this is a weaker concept of no one is certain. It would be wonderful if someone could prove that all the digits of in pi, all the digits are equally likely, 0 to 9. It seems to be the case, but no one can prove it. But this is a weaker notion of randomness than mine. Omega, a number that is a number that's random according to my definition, and you can prove from this that not only all its digits have equal frequency, but you can prove many, many other, in fact, all possible statistical properties of randomness in Martynov's sense. So pi looks like it's random in some senses, but no one is certain. No one has proved it. But unfortunately, according to my theory is very demanding. It's a very impractical theory. It's sort of the most demanding possible definition of randomness, which is why people don't use it in the field of theoretical computer science called mathematical cryptography, because my definition is too demanding. So
if you compare omega with pi, omega is the worst monster, if we can say that.
Yes. Omega. You can prove that omega is random in every possible statistical sense, and pi certainly is not that random. Even if it may be a little random, it seems it's a little random, but no one is certain. Unfortunately, it would be a mathematical breakthrough if someone could demonstrate that the digits of pi are equally likely. It looks like they are, but no one is certain. So I believe there's a book in French by Jean-Paul Delahaye talking about pi, where he does mention omega, I think, somewhere.
I will look at it. In the beginning of the century, the German mathematician David Hilbert ambitioned to codify the mathematical reasoning in a general system of axioms. In the 30s, he wanted the system to be consistent and complete. And in the 30s, Gödel showed that if we suppose a formal system is consistent, then it is incomplete. The implications of Gödel's theorem are radical and quite devastating. Why, according to you, Gödel's incompleteness has such an impact outside the discipline of mathematics, and why it has inspired so many interpretations, even in social sciences?
Oh, well, yeah, I let me hazard a guess. I think the reason is that if you go back to Plato, what I'm saying now are ideas really from a friend of mine, the philosopher Walter Mayerstein, who has written books in French with a colleague of his. I can't remember offhand the title of his book. Oh yes, here it is: Puissance et limite de la raison. Luc Brisson and F. Walter Mayerstein. It's published by Les Belles Lettres in Paris. Anyway, I've discussed this with him, and I don't know much about philosophy, but Walter has explained to me that one school of thought in philosophy that goes back to Plato greatly admires mathematical reasoning, and what Plato tries to do, this philosophical fantasy, is to use mathematical to be able to answer questions about ethics or morality, or to be able to answer philosophical questions with arguments that are as convincing as mathematical arguments. In other words, the school of philosophy coming from Plato looks at mathematics as as, how do you say, the supreme example of reasoning, and tries to have that same, tries to make, to bring that same kind of rational approach to other questions outside of mathematics. And that was the goal. And then for this school, not all philosophy follows this line of thought or this line of attack, but for those who do, Gödel's result is very shocking because it sort of pulls the rug out from under pure reasoning. And so then if pure mathematics is uncertain about its own foundations, then what about other fields which are messier and more complicated in the real world, where how can we be... the hope had been to bring mathematical certainty into other areas of human thought that are not outside of mathematics, that are of more interest for real life. But if mathematics itself has serious doubts about its own veracity, then what are we to do in messier areas which are more significant for us as human beings? I think that's the reason for the shock, part of the reason for the shock. I don't think that one should that Gödel's results or my results should lead one to despair. I think what it means is, well, one cannot have absolute certainty about anything, is my tentative conclusion, and therefore one can still try to be reasonable, but being reasonable involves, instead of deducing consequences from generally accepted axioms and then proving to everyone one's conclusions, I think that being reasonable involves discussing things with other people, thinking about it, using one's intuition, trying to, how do you say, have a consensus emerge. I don't know what to do. I mean, an extreme reaction would be to say, well, reason is bankrupt, therefore let's use force to convince people. I think that would be a horrible conclusion, a horrible position to take about Gödel's work. I think a better way to look at Gödel is to say that even in pure mathematics realizes its own limitations, even in the most certain of all fields, because mathematical reasoning is much more certain than reasoning in physics, and certainly more certain than reasoning about in law or sociology or psychology. But even there, mathematical reasoning shows that it has limits. So therefore, maybe one should realize that there are serious limits to every field of human knowledge, and one should be, how do you say, perhaps more modest or more... more tentative, yes. Less dogmatic. Absolutely. That would be my feeling, at least. But of course, there are an infinite variety of opinions.
Can we see the system of mathematical proofs that Hildeberg wanted to reach as a perfect system, where the truth is something very vertical, diffusing from the top down? And yeah. can we see randomness as a bottom-up data procedure that denies the possibility for a formal system to have this proof efficiency? Can we present the things like this, something vertical?
Yes, that would be one way of looking at it. If Hilbert had succeeded, as you say, mathematical truth would be... I think it's a good image you've presented. Mathematical truth would be absolute, black and white. It would be very dogmatic. It would be like a central... Well, I don't understand politics, but it would be an authoritarian system, shall we say. I don't know.
But for the ordinary person...
But it doesn't turn out to be that way.
Until Gödel, for the ordinary people, mathematics is the realm of truth, impeccability, and infallibility.
Right.
The second scientist who shakes the foundation of mathematics was Alan Turing. In formulating his famous machine, he found the uncomputability of the Hawking problem.
Right.
This problem is more difficult to understand for a general public, but you focused on the fact that what can be seen as a defeat for reasoning also can be considered as a victory for computation. I like this paradox.
Yes, thank you.
Of the Hawking problem shows that formalism for reasoning is incomplete. But, as you mentioned, Turing also proposed a universal formalism for computing.
Mm-hmm.
So, here again we have a big paradox that what appears in mathematics as a failure becomes a powerful success in science computing. So
technology, yes.
And technology, so
that's right. Formalism failed is a glorious failure because Hilbert's original reason for being in favor of formalism was for mathematical reasoning, and there it has failed. But for computing, or for algorithms, for calculations, formalism is the biggest success of the technology of this century. It's computer programming languages. Everyone is using these formal languages for computing, for computers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very surprising historical fact. So I think it's not fair to say that Hilbert was a failure, his program. In a very strange way, unexpected way, it was a tremendous success as a technology, which is another paradox of this whole intellectual history. This surprising intellectual history in which mathematics examines itself, its own foundations, finds its own foundations to be wanting, not to be secure enough, but some of the work that was for this philosophical purpose turns out to be work that helps to lead to computer technology. If you look at Gödel's and Turing's original papers, with the hindsight of now, if you look at the 1931 paper by Gödel and the 1936 paper by Turing, I see computer programming languages in each of these papers. At that time, there were no computers, there were no computer programming languages. But Gödel's paper uses a computer programming language that is much like Lisp, a language used for artificial intelligence. And Turing's paper has what nowadays we would call a machine language, a very primitive language, at the hardware level, at the machine level. So this work, whose purpose was epistemological, was to clarify the limits of knowledge, in fact, I think it clearly helped to lead to computer technology, which is a tremendous success. But the computers don't reason, computers calculate, they compute. So it's a success in a different direction than Hilbert envisioned, but nevertheless, formalism has succeeded in this century in a very dramatic way.
In programming, essentially.
Exactly.
And
in mathematical reasoning.
Yeah, and the dream of Hilbert, you reduce it as a program language. In fact, the fact that you want to create a grammar system with syntax, etc. So it a formal axiomatic system with a specific alphabet, grammar rules, and formal syntax, consistency, and completeness. All these characteristics correspond to a program. Is that what you mean?
Yes, except for consistency and completeness, which deal with reasoning.
Yeah, with music.
Yeah, the rest sounds very familiar nowadays. When Hilbert said it, it sounded very unfamiliar. But now any of us who have used computers, who have programmed a computer, we've worked with such a language. That's the only way to communicate with a computer. So strangely enough, Hilbert's failure is a tremendously glorious failure, in a way. In several ways. First, because it leads to Gödel's and Turing's work. And my own, but secondly, because it helps to lead to the development of computer. as one of the fathers of the computer, there were many things that led to the computer. It's not just one person or one set of ideas. History is complicated, but this is one of the threads, one of the rivers that leads to the development of the computer as a technology, which is an amazing. I think it's an amazing piece of intellectual history that work whose motivation was essentially philosophical turns out to have such a big impact on human society.
Absolutely, with a tool, a very powerful tool, the computer. I mean.
Mm-hmm. Although Leibniz probably would not be surprised. Leibniz had envisioned all of this, I think, philosophically, hundreds of years ago, when he talked about replacing reasoning by calculation, replacing argument in words by calculation.
You quote Leibniz saying that in Jaeger the paradox sans utilité. What is the utility, the ultimate nature of your mathematical paradoxes?
I think the utility is that it helps one to understand the limits of reasoning. That's the paradoxes that I discuss in my book all help to have positive aspects. They're surprising at first. At first, they seem to lead to be contradictory, to show that reasoning is self-contradictory. But when you look at them more closely, as Gödel does. Instead of saying this statement is false and saying therefore reasoning is bankrupt, he says this statement is unprovable, and he deduces his famous incompleteness result. So all of these paradoxes help to clarify the limits of reasoning. I think it was who was it? Someone said that. You know, at first you think these paradoxes are all very childish and that an adult shouldn't waste time on them. But I think it was Gödel who said that really the paradoxes show that our normal logical and mathematical intuition is self-contradictory, that they're absolutely fundamental. Historically, they led to all of this self-analysis of the limits of reasoning. So, at first you might think they are word games, that one should, one laughs when one hears one of these paradoxes, but then normally you think, you have to dismiss it. You can't stop. Reasoning doesn't come to a stop simply because you arrive at a contradiction when you consider someone who says, I'm saying a lie. But Gödel's work comes from these paradoxes. He took them seriously, and that was part of his genius. So Leibniz had envisioned a notion very similar to Hilbert's. He spoke about, about something he called a characteristica universalis. Leibniz's vision was a symbolic logic, a way of doing reasoning the way you do arithmetical calculations to avoid disputes. That was the dream. So it's a similar notion, I think, to Hilbert's.
Hilbert, yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
After Gödel's incompleteness, then came Turing and computability, and after you with your randomness.
Right.
Are incompleteness, incomputability, and randomness three different manifestations of the limits of mathematics?
Yes, they're different. They're really different.
Could we discover...
They're different reasons. Yes, we can talk about this, sure, certainly.
In other words, could we discover your randomness independently from the Turing incomputable or from Gödel's incompleteness, or should we understand the complete historical progression of these three notions?
Well, I think it's very helpful to look at the history of the evolution of these ideas, right? But the ideas are independent in the sense that Gödel's incompleteness theorem, as he carried it out, Turing cannot deduce Gödel's result using his methods. the specific results that Gödel, the specific incompleteness results, that the specific assertion, which is true but unprovable, that Gödel exhibits, is different from what Turing comes up with. On the previous one, I don't think that Turing could have done his work without Hilbert and Gödel, and I certainly couldn't have done my work without Gödel and Turing. But they're actually different. None of these pieces of work subsumes or includes the previous.
Okay.
They're actually different sources of limits of reasoning. The three pieces of work.
I think.
Yes. Yes. I'm sorry.
Sorry. Go ahead. Sorry, I've interrupted you.
I think that each of these steps makes the limits of reasoning clearer. It seems more inevitable. I think with Gödel's result, it's tremendously shocking and surprising that there are limits of reasoning. With Turing's work, it seems more natural. That was my own reaction to Gödel's work, that it seemed very surprising. It seemed rather fragile, his proof, in a way, very complicated and maybe fragile. Fragile means it depends on too many details. Now, with Turing's work, the limits of reasoning seems much more natural. He's talking about machines, and he's talking about things that machines can't do, and therefore reasoning can't do. And this almost sounds like physics, the way Gödel does it, the way Turing does it. So it sounds like a much bigger problem. It sounds more natural. Now, with my work, what happens is that incompleteness and the limits of reasoning is not surprising the way it was with Gödel. It's not natural the way it is with. It doesn't seem more natural the way it is with Turing. In fact, it seems inevitable. In other words, wherever you turn, you smash into the limits of reasoning in my field. It's sort of inescapable. So it seems more natural, I think, with my viewpoint. But there are really three different sets of ideas, none of which includes the other two.
Okay.
So these are different sources of incompleteness. These are different problems.
Just a small pragmatic question. Do we have an idea about the size and density of the set of the theorems that are true by accident? Can we compare it in terms of proportion to the set of theorems that are proved?
Well, that's a very good question. That's sort of, I think, the most basic question. And the answer is, I can say a few things about this, but only in certain limited areas. If you're asking, can I prove that a number is random, in my sense, the answer is it's almost always the case that it's random, but you can never prove it, only in finitely many cases. So almost all numbers are random, but only a small number can be proved to be random. So that's a case where incompleteness is really everywhere. But what about natural mathematical questions? What about the kind of mathematical questions that mathematicians care about in their ordinary work? And there is no clear answer yet. More research is necessary to answer this question. But my work was motivated. Part of the reason I did my work was exactly to answer that question that you've asked, which is to understand, is incompleteness something? Well, the way Gödel shows that establishes incompleteness, it might be that the mathematical assertions which are true but unprovable are extremely strange, unnatural, and unimportant. With Gödel, it begins to look more serious, and with my work even more serious. But the real question is, as you say, to know what happens with in general. You know, how bad is the problem? How bad is incompleteness? And I have a colleague, a Romanian colleague in Auckland, New Zealand, Christian Kalude, who's done some work on this. It's not even clear how to ask the question. So he he uses some topological methods. I believe he shows that in a certain topological sense that questions which cannot be answered are everywhere dense. More work is needed, but my work certainly suggests that incompleteness is much more prevalent, happens much more often than seems to be the case based on the work of Gödel. But every piece of mathematical research answers some questions but raises more questions. So I think much more work is necessary. I think the question you've asked is really the key question. And you see, what about natural mathematical questions? You see, Fermat's last theorem was recently demonstrated by Wiles. Right. And that's a famous result that I used to think perhaps escaped the power of the normal methods of mathematical reasoning. When I was a child, there was something called the four-color conjecture, which is, can all maps be colored using only four colors so that countries which share a border have different colors, so you don't confuse the two countries. And someone managed with the help of a computer to show that four colors are enough, suffice. And recently this proof has been improved, but it has more ideas now and less computing, but still a lot of computing. And then there's a famous conjecture called the Riemann conjecture, which no one knows. So the question is, what about real mathematics? And how often does incompleteness arise there? And the past 30 years has people have settled two of the three outstanding mathematical questions that were open, which were the four-color conjecture, Fermat's last theorem, and the Riemann hypothesis. So the curious situation is that the experience of the mathematical community suggests that that mathematics is doing beautifully, progressing beautifully, and the results by Gödel, Turing, and myself suggest the opposite. So I think there's a contradiction. I mean, it's not a contradiction, but it would be interesting to understand how come mathematics works so well. It would be interesting to get positive results showing how come, in spite of the incompleteness results, mathematics does work as well as it works. And that's related to the question you raised, which is to ask, is incompleteness common, or is it happen only in unusual circumstances? To understand if it affects mathematical questions that mathematicians are normally interested in, natural mathematical questions. And so this is an area which requires much more thought. It's not even clear what a natural mathematical question is. You see, my work is too negative. So I think some positive results would be interesting. I think more needs to be done to answer your question, which is a very good question.
Thank you. 2,000 years of tradition in mathematics have been destabilized by the new way initiated by Gödel, Turing, and you. However, could you find in the history of mathematics some events or some thinkers, you mentioned Leibniz, that have tried to reconsider the logical certitude of mathematics? You mentioned Leibniz. Do we have another thinker or mathematician who tried to reconsider, who tried to rejoin the way you think about mathematics?
First, let me say that mathematics is constantly changing and evolving. Even if you look historically at mathematics, each century does mathematics differently. So it may be that mathematical reasoning is more certain than any other form of reasoning, but still, it mathematics does change. The questions that mathematicians look at and the kind of way they reason historically does change. And another thing I think I should say is that that's continuing now. mathematics, I think the biggest change in mathematics now is not because of Gödel's work or Turing's work or my own work, it's because of the computer. The kind of mathematical questions that one asks and the kind of answers one wants are different when there are lots of computers than in the world before the computer. And so mathematicians now are more concerned with what can be calculated than they were before. And this is a different kind of mathematics. It's a constructive mathematics. It's a mathematics of what can be computed. It's less abstract than the mathematics before the computer. And I think that's been the biggest change in mathematics, I think, lately, although some mathematicians are very pure and abstract and refuse to have anything to do with computers, not only they don't want to use them, but they don't want to be, how do you say, corrupted by the concept of a computer, of an algorithm either. They want to do mathematics the same abstract way,
pure way,
before. But I think other mathematicians who are less theoretical are being influenced by the computer in the kinds of questions they look at and the kinds of answers they are interested in. And it's true that that in a way Gödel's work, Turing's and my own, provides some theoretical justification for this. But in fact, I think the sociology of it is different. It's really due to the computer more than anything else. The change in the kind of mathematics that people are doing. Certainly in physics it's true, because before physicists looked for solutions to equations and that they could write on a piece of paper, and now physicists are doing enormous calculations on computers. So that's a different way of doing mathematics in physics. The influence of the computer within pure mathematics itself is, I think, a little less direct, but I think it does exist also. I'm sorry, you started to ask another question.
You advocate the need to the discipline to resource itself in the way paved by the quasi-empirism. So you mentioned the computing as a way to build new foundation, but also the similarity with the physics research. Some of your affirmations reminds me the statements of Niels Bohr about the contradictory paradox. For instance, when you say that some mathematical statements are true for no reason, this reminds me some the statement of Niels Bohr concerning quantum physics. If we have to make a comparison with the physics world, can we say that what happened to your discipline is similar to the split between classical and quantum mechanics, for example?
Yes, Von Neumann was one of my childhood heroes, a well-known mathematician in the earlier part of his century, and he has an essay where he said that most people are aware of the tremendous revolution in physics in this century because of relativity theory and quantum mechanics, right, which were very revolutionary. But they're not aware that in this century there has also been a revolution in our way of thinking about the foundations of mathematics, that this was a dramatic controversy that outside the profession was not well known. And I think, yes, to me they do seem analogous, these, especially in the case of quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics is also dealing with the notion of randomness. Is the physical universe deterministic, or is there randomness in the physical universe? In fact, it was part of the inspiration for my own work. I think the moral of the story is that no field is exempt from the crises and soul searching in this century. Even pure mathematics, or the philosophy of mathematics, which one might think is far removed from normal life, this century has there have been crises. So the crises are not only in politics and in the history of this century. There have been lots of crises, but even in pure thought. So which is a surprising fact that is not well known. Although by now Ghetto has been discussed widely by intellectuals, as you I think pointed out in a question you asked me. So the situation is not exactly the way it was when von Neumann wrote this essay.
Could we say that all sciences, and the sciences in general, at the age of the third millennium, are in a sense unified by the recurrent generic that was formulated by Prigogine, la fin des certitudes, the end of certitude? Could be. I discovered that in each science we have this kind of discovery that there is no more certitude, absolute truth, and it seems that it's a recurrent
combination. Yes, well, definitely, but one should be cautious. It's one extreme reaction is to say that science is bankrupt,
yeah.
That science is finished, science is useless, that everything is a matter of opinion, and that would be an overreaction. I think what is certainly true, as Professor Prigogine points out, is that in this century, many different fields of science have become more aware of their own limitations. That's certainly true in mathematics and physics. More cautious, also, about their foundations. But I still think that science is a good way to try to understand the world within the limits of the questions that it can approach, right? It's not good for for everything, but I think, isn't there a discussion, there's a book by Sokal and Bricmont, what's it called?
Sokal and Bricmont, yes, yes, it's about Les Impostures Intellectuelles.
Les Impostures Intellectuelles, and there's a chapter there attacking people that Bricmont and Sokal claim are intellectuals reacting to Ghetto without understanding him. I'm not sure that they're right. I have another friend in Canada. His name is Vladimir Tazik, and he's actually from Yugoslavia, I believe. He's in New Brunswick, Canada now, and he's written a book that hasn't been published yet. I hope it will be published, on the philosophy of mathematics, connecting the crisis provoked by Ghetto's incompleteness theorem with the whole postmodernist movement, where he. So his viewpoint is that mathematicians should be sympathetic to the postmodern movement, because in some ways its intellectual heritage goes back to Ghetto. There are many reasons for the postmodern movement. On the other hand, you would know better than I. I've heard some people say that now there's a reaction even in the French-speaking world against postmodernism.
Yes, that's right.
So everything is well. One of the things one could say about Ghetto is, when I was young, everything seemed very clear to me, and as I get older, things seem more complicated. And before I used to think that for any question there was a very clear answer, and now my feeling is that everything is very complicated in real life, and there are always many viewpoints, and they all have some truth. But you have to look at them all together to get a better picture. But this is probably the same thing that you've observed. I think this is, as one grows older, I think human beings have more experience of the complexity of human life, and they naturally, I think, tend in this direction, at least it seems to me. I don't know about yourself.
Yeah, I have the same feeling. For me personally, I mean, what you, your philosophical ideas are not negative. I don't see that as pessimistic. I consider it as a new way to rethink the reasoning in science, but also in other in the way we live, in the way we interact with environment. It's the famous paradigm shift, etc. But
I think it's clear we're going through a paradigm shift in the sciences and technology in general.
Concerning the mathematics, until now most of mathematicians were Platonicians.
Mm-hmm.
And for you, would you say that you are more interested in quasi-empirism? Would you say that mathematics precedes existence, or is it social construction, a modality of reality? Is mathematics a human invention or discovery? You know, the famous debate.
Right.
Is mathematics a product of human thought and also of computation now? It's a new direction. What is your
my feeling about this? Well, my feeling is that, you know, I'm a mathematician, so Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I feel like a Platonist.
Okay.
Because in my work, I deal, for example, with all of the positive integers, with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, going on forever. You know, this is the mathematical notion of infinity. And if you take, you know, a normal human being will say, this is nonsense, this is a fantasy, infinity is beyond human, the grasp of human beings. But if you take away 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then what's left of mathematics? So Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I feel like a Platonist. Now Tuesday... Tuesday and Thursday, I feel more like a physicist, in other words, quasi-empirical, and I don't know, Saturday and Sunday, I don't know what to think. As you say, mathematics is a human activity, if you look at it historically, and it does change. The kind of questions that mathematicians are interested in that are fashionable and the kinds of methods that are used, it does change if you look at the history of mathematics. So I think there's some truth in all of these viewpoints. I don't have a dogmatic view that only one, that, you know, that there is one philosophy of mathematics that answers all the questions. I think it's complicated and that all of these viewpoints have something to contribute to answer these questions.
There's no absolute definition. I mean, you have no categorical answer to...
Right.
You mentioned the way to resource mathematics. You mentioned the way that mathematicians have to behave more empirically. But you also said that the only way to deal with the theorems that are true at random is to accept them as axioms. But my question, in adding axioms to mathematics, you inject more and more elements of faith in the discipline. So the limitation of reasoning implies, in a way, the augmentation of the axiomatic set, which also augments the faith within the system. It's not a problem, there's not a contradiction or negative feedback or something like this. If we
add new axioms, it's becoming less certain. You're saying?
Yes, they're more less and less certain. The system is less and less certain. It's not a problem. I mean, do you have a reaction to this proposition?
It's
very pragmatic in a way, but in the other sense, we feel that we lack the sense of certitude.
Right. Right. Well, I certainly don't think that, you know, everyone should do mathematics, should stop doing mathematics the way they're doing it now. I mean, the traditional kind of mathematics is certainly more solid than if you add new axioms based on empirical evidence. So what I would distinguish would be between a mathematical proof that everyone could agree on would be the best thing one could do. And then if you have to use an unproved hypothesis to demonstrate a mathematical assertion, that would be less convincing. So then a proof that didn't need that, and the more empirical hypotheses one needed to add to prove something, the less convincing the proof would be. I'm not a revolutionary. I don't want to say that mathematics should be done differently, but what I think perhaps is that mathematicians should allow proofs, should accept that some proofs are more convincing than others, and allow proofs that are not absolutely convincing because they are also helpful in understanding what's going on. That's how a physicist would work at any rate, you see. My impression is that it's a mistake for mathematicians to always demand absolute certainty in proofs. It's good if you can do it, if you don't need unproved hypotheses in a proof. Of course, that's wonderful, but perhaps sometimes you do, and I think this should also be considered to be a proof. It's just not as convincing as a proof without unproved hypotheses. But I think maybe such proofs could play a role. They certainly play a role in mathematical discovery. Mathematicians often act like empirical scientists to make discoveries, but after they discover something, they try to find a complete proof, and then they usually erase all the train of thought that led to the discovery. All I'm suggesting is that perhaps to be able to work in some areas of pure mathematics which are extremely difficult, one should allow, for example, the Riemann hypothesis or other unproved hypotheses that seem very fertile to be used. But then such proofs would be less convincing than a proof that didn't need such uncertain elements. So I'm not as revolutionary as you might think from reading some of my statements. I'm not saying the traditional mathematics is wrong. I'm saying maybe one should expand a little bit what is viewed as mathematics. And in fact, mathematical physicists already behave this way. So in a way, all I'm saying is I think they're doing mathematics too. It's just not as solid as the traditional mathematics, but it can have a role to play also. So that's a less dramatic way to say what I'm saying.
The orientation towards quasi-empirical empirism, and to behave a little bit like the physician to
right
theories and
the exactly theory.
The self-reference mechanism plays an important role in revealing the logical contradiction in the reasoning. It seems that the self, the element self, plays an important role in the emergence of paradoxes as well as for some mechanism of organization, which are, for example, at the origin of the feedback of the information theory. What means this notion of self-reference in the context of your theory of information and even beyond mathematics? What do you have to say concerning this notion of self-reference?
Yes, well, actually less than you might think. Yeah, some people are very fascinated by the self-referential aspect of Gödel's proof. There's a wonderful book called Gödel Escherbach by Douglas Hofstadter that emphasizes this aspect. And Hofstadter believes that the self-reference is connected with human consciousness. It's the ability, our ability to think about ourselves.
Yeah, it's that the origin of the theory of emergence or things like that, no? The self that creates the loop.
Yes, I think Hofstadter and some others are fascinated by this. Now, interestingly enough, this was what bothered me about Gödel's original proof.
Yeah, I read that in your book.
It seemed fragile to me. It worried. It disturbed me. I was looking for another path. So in my own work, I'm just talking about randomness and information, and the self-reference really it does not play as big a role in my work. So.
You want to avoid it to make clear that logical reasoning is limited. I mean, you want to avoid this argument, is that right?
Exactly. Because some people, including myself, felt uncomfortable with the self-reference in Gödel's proof. It looked like a paradox. It seemed hard to grasp intuitively. So with my approach, I want to avoid it. In my approach, I talk about amount of information in the axioms versus the amount of information in a theorem you're trying to prove. Or I talk about randomness. I was trying to find an alternate view, a different viewpoint than Gödel's original viewpoint, in order to understand better his result. Now, you might laugh and say, well, the reason I did all my work is in a way because I could read Gödel's proof, but I felt I couldn't understand it. I felt uncomfortable. If I had been smarter, I would have said, of course, Gödel's proof is correct. There's no problem. And then I wouldn't have done any of the research I did afterwards. So the reason I could do a different viewpoint is because I felt uncomfortable with Gödel's original proof. I mean, I realized it was correct. It worked step by step. But somehow, I felt I couldn't really understand it. So my approach to trying to understand it is to find a different viewpoint that avoids the self-reference. I have a self-reference in my work, but it's a much weaker self-reference. I don't think it's the kind of self-reference that Douglas Hofstadter or others might think is connected with consciousness or emergence. But they're all related issues. In a way, the emergence, the notion of emergence in my theory has to do with increasing information. This is how
you can link with the
higher levels. In when you talk about self-reference, you talk about higher levels or meta levels or meta levels or emergence of new concepts at a higher level. And this corresponds in my theory to more information in the axioms. So I think actually my approach doesn't contradict Gödel's approach. It complements it. It provides another view of this same set of issues. In my case, I emphasize information and randomness rather than self-reference. But all of these things are connected. They're all related.
My last question is that you wrote about the limits of mathematics, building what you consider a pessimistic theoretical work, but you remain an optimistic researcher. How do you see the future of mathematics in relation with what you mentioned before, the role of information, the epistemology of information? What could be said for the future of mathematics and the big paradigm that will govern it for the coming years?
Yes. Well, I'm an optimist. To do research, you have to be an optimist to try to achieve new understanding. You have to be very optimistic. You not only have to believe that it's possible to go forward in a field, you have to even believe that perhaps you yourself might be able to do a little bit of that. So it requires optimism, definitely, to do research. But I think I'm optimistic about the future of mathematics because, for example, the computer is a new concept in mathematics that's very fruitful. My own work, I think, shows that information and randomness, which are concepts that come from outside of mathematics, can be used in mathematics. So there's a tremendous amount of progress in mathematics in this century. Wiles' proof of Fermat's Last Theorem is an example. So, and hope, and now we in the future we will be able to use the computer as assistance in our research more and more, you know, to help us with calculations and so we're using the web more and more to communicate mathematics in ways that couldn't be done before. You've taken a look at a book of mine that isn't published yet. It's being printed right now, by the way, in Singapore. It may take a while to reach Europe and the United States, but you already saw it on the web. I'm optimistic. 100 years ago, no one knew that the electrons existed. I think the electron is only a few years more than 100 years old. They had a birthday party for the electron at Cambridge, I think just a few years ago. Was it 96? Was it 1996? I'm not sure. So there's been tremendous progress in this century, not only technologically, but also intellectually and scientifically for fundamental concepts. And I hope the next century will be the same way. Of course, there are tremendous risks. We have our demons, right?
What kind of demons?
War, poverty, all kinds of problems that could lead to catastrophe. We're all aware of them. When I was a child, I remember reading a science fiction story which imagined a future where science and technology were absolutely amazing. You could travel to other stars, but the society depicted in this future with amazing technology was a society with tremendous problems. And I naively, as a child, thought that's impossible. If human beings have such advanced science and such advanced technology, then human society will also have to be wonderful. It cannot be with all the problems of that we have nowadays. Well, that shows how naive I was, right? In our own, compared to 100 years ago, human technology and human science has advanced enormously, and I hope that the lives of many humans, of many people, is better than it would have been 100 years ago. But we all are very well aware that things are not perfect, right? There are tremendous problems. So I don't know what's going to happen this coming century, but I recently gave a talk at Lowell, Massachusetts, where they've made a historical national park. This was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in the United States. They are textile mills, and they used water power. Lowell, Massachusetts had a great many textile mills because these mills could be run using water power. This was before steam, even. And so a little more than 100 years ago, everyone in this town worked all day long in these mills, in these factories. It must have been terrible. And I probably would have been one of these people working in these mills, right, at that time. And now more people get a university education and have opportunities which probably they would not have had 150 years ago. So I think there is progress. We are aware that there's progress, but we're also aware that there are many dangers in the coming century. The dangers are the possibilities for progress are tremendous, and also the dangers are tremendous. Who knows what's going to happen? I hope human beings will somehow find a way to control their demons and go forward. Like they could, if we don't, if we're not destroyed by wars or other catastrophes, I think the possibilities are wonderful. But it's going to be an interesting century, I think. Don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Now things are going very, very rapidly, and I think a lot of things are happening, especially in science also.
And the world- becoming more and more like a single community, global village, which never happened before. So, as you say, the rate of change is very great. So I think partly that's the reason for your book, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it's a way to celebrate the millennium. I'm coming from social sciences, and I've been a little bit disappointed by all the great ideologies and the problem in politics, etc. And I found the best way to celebrate the millennium is to see creativity and the debates that are in the science now. So
I quite agree with you.
It's very inspiring to look at science now, especially now that science is more and more a central subject in our culture. The techno culture is everywhere. We have a technological environment, and science became more and more central in the human culture. So we cannot stay ignorant of what is happening.
But that can't solve all our problems, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's not. We don't hope that scientists rules the world, but they have their work. It deserves to hear what they say, what they discover in the research.
Yes, well, Bertrand Russell made a remark like that. He has a book on happiness, on what is happiness and human happiness, and how to be happy. And he says, of course, that among literary intellectuals like himself, it's not fashionable to be happy. Everyone's unhappy. Everyone's divorced. Everyone's unhappy. But he said that some of his friends who are scientists are so simple outside their work that they're actually able to enjoy their marriage, for example, he says, because really all they care about is what goes on in their lab. I don't understand. I mean, he made a remark like that in a way scientists are like children, because instead of facing all the problems of human existence, they're concentrating on the problems in their limited field where they're able to make progress. So that gives them a certain childish optimism. Your remark reminded me of reading this humorous statement by Bertrand Russell in his book, I think it was called The Conquest of Happiness or something like that, about what to do for individuals to be happy. I don't know if he was talking about how to make a happier human society.
And also, science now is a way to be more and more aware of our dependency to the natural environment. It's a way to be enchanted by the environment.
Well,
mathematics, you were a young prodigy, I think. You were working on mathematics at the age of 15.
The idea for, I'm largely, in some ways I'm self-taught. And the idea of program size complexity I had when I was 15, actually. And my first major paper on this subject was written when I was 18 and published when I was 19 in the Journal of the Association for Computing Machinery, the international journal for specialists. So yes, I've had an interesting life.
Yeah, you entered in science very early.
Very young, that's right.